is walking around every day being aware that I can be killed for no reason at all. And knowing that it's on me to stop that from happening. I can't trust that the police are going to stop from happening or the people around me are going to stop from happening. I have to sort of try to go out in the world with the home training that my mom gave me and try to make sure I don't end up in a situation where I'm going to be killed for no reason at all by a police officer. That felt like a wake-up call. Trayvon Martin certainly felt like another wake-up call. And now here we are with Michael Brown. And we're not that far past Eric Garner. And somewhere right now in the streets, sadly, is some black man who's walking around who's going to be murdered by a police officer. And it's just my job to do all I can to make sure I'm not that black man. Doesn't mean I can control it. It can happen at any time for any reason, as we've seen from all these things. But it's my job, because I have a wife and a daughter on the way, and I'd like to be around from them, to try to make sure it's not me.
Subscribe on YouTube, follow us on Twitter, and like us on Facebook.
Okay, so I'm going to invite the panelists up. Melinda, you. So let's give these guys a round of applause. Welcome them to... So... Thank you so much for coming on to the hot spot with such a sensitive, challenging issue. Why don't we just quickly introduce ourselves? Do you want to start off there, Melinda?
I'm Melinda Anderson. I've been a member of Cedar Ridge for about 10 years, and I'm on the Cedar Ridge Board of Trustees. I'm Sarah Clark. I've been here for a couple years.
You've been here a couple of years, and you're a group leader, right? Leader,
yes,
discipleship group.
Yes, we have a discipleship group.
Great. And how old are you, Devin? Tell us how old.
14.
Okay, so I'm only a little older than you then, so okay, that's cool. Now we've got some things that are going up overhead on these slides, which some of these will be running through while we're talking. Melinda, do you want to just explain a little bit about that for some context?
Yes, these slides are called the Race Card Project. Michelle Norris, who works for National Public Radio. And the idea was that in order to start conversations on race, it can be very difficult. And so she asked people to use six words that would express their experience with race. And it's now grown into this really rich archive. But the idea is that through those six words, there are stories behind those six words. And those six words can be an opening to have a conversation about race, the kind of thing that we're having here this morning.
That's cool. That's great. How are we doing on sound? Can you hear us all okay? Not too well. What, can you hear me right now? Yeah. Okay, so could you hear that? Okay, we're going to try and work that out as we go through. What we're going to try and do here is have a bit of a conversation together. Which is, you know, it's a little awkward because we've sat in front of all these people. But we're hoping to have a conversation. I've got some questions here that I'm going to ask each of the panelists. And we hope that together we'll be able to have a similar kind of conversation after the service. So we're going to do this for a while, and then we'll sing some songs together as we usually do. And then we'll break and have the discussion around these tables. But just to sort of get us started off, and maybe Melinda, you could start off on this. A question for all of us here, really, is when did you first become aware of race? When was that? How did that happen for you?
I think for me, it's not so much when I became aware of race, but when I had the feeling of being othered because of race. And I would say that started probably in elementary school. My parents, I grew up in Philadelphia, West Philadelphia, in a predominantly black neighborhood, and my parents moved to the Main Line. For those who know Philadelphia, the Main Line is a suburban area. And we were one of two black families in our elementary school. So I went from an environment where I was around predominantly black community to being in a school where everything defined me by my race. I was different, mm-hmm. I looked different, my hair was different, and so you understand going into that environment as a child, suddenly you are different and everything is defined by you being different, not part of the general group. And I think that probably is mirrored by a lot of people in society, because we grow up in a society in general where as a minority, although we're now actually majority in America, the fact is that you are surrounded in situations, you're born into a culture where you are always the other. And that's part of your racial identity. And then that dovetails to what we saw in that video, where the perceptions and the assumptions that are made about you because of that.
Yeah, thanks for that. What about you, Sarah?
I kind of had the opposite experience. I was not the other. I grew up in a small town in Michigan outside of Ann Arbor, that it was predominantly overwhelmingly white. So I became aware of race by knowing the one Cambodian refugee family that was in town. I think there was a girl from Romania, and I had a friend from Taiwan who moved in. So there were not a lot of people of color in our town, but we didn't have a TV. So I became aware of race. I was a kid watching Fat Albert, Good Times, The Jeffersons, what's the show with Rerun, you know. Shortly after that, I remember our family watched the miniseries Roots. So really it was watching TV where I became aware of, you know, these are people who did not look like me, talk like me, live like me, and I was just forming impressions of what they looked like or who they were. My family moved to South Carolina when I was in high school, and that was just a big wake-up call for me because I had never really been around very many people of color. And in my high school, there was significant busing and integration, so I was around a lot more African Americans. But the first relationship I had a mall job. I worked at the Peanut Shack selling candy and nuts, and there was a African American girl from my high school. You know, we were in student government together, we saw each other, but we didn't ever interact in school. But it was at the Peanut Shack that we had these conversations, and you know, we talked about some things that we, you know, didn't talk about in school, and that's where I learned how we were similar and how we were different. And I think the one thing I would say I'm aware of as we have these conversations here at Cedar Ridge is, you know, as a white person or whoever you are, is just the importance of paying attention to our own identity. And, you know, if you have ever thought about, well, those people are like XYZ, and I think it's pretty impossible to grow up in a culture and not have had that experience where you're thinking, oh, that's how they are. That, you know, for me, I think it's important to stop and wonder, like, oh, well, what's my XYZ? You know, as a white person, what does that mean for me to be white and to be, I'm actually a part of a group of white people.
Mm-hmm. Cool. Thank you. What about you, Deb?
I think I like experiencing race, like noticing it when in like seventh or eighth grade, because like stereotypes, I started learning about stereotypes, like, and there was a song that people used to sing. It had a bunch of different stereotypes about people, and that's when I originally like started paying attention to this type of thing. And then high school, it started becoming more like obvious, like people would make jokes or like talk about race, kind of, and in, like we all started learning about it more in government and other classes. Like, so a few years ago was when I started like actually noticing and hearing about race, and lately it's become more and more obvious to me.
I want to go back to Sarah. Actually, we hadn't thought about this, but you're married to a black man, right? So how has that impacted your awareness, or what did that change anything for you? I mean, what tell us a little bit about that.
Well, I would say a lot of my awareness has just come in layers. So, and it's been kind of complicated and taken a lot of time. So I had different experiences, and you know, Hubert and I were talking about this last night. He was like,
"Where's Hubert?" There he is.
You know, if you hadn't had that job in Peanut Shack and talked to Rita, maybe we wouldn't be married. You know.
Right.
But
couples always say that kind of thing, though, don't they?
So, you know, I had different experiences. My first real boss and mentor was an African-American woman. I met Hubert. We were friends for like 10 years before we decided
friends.
To get married. We were friends. We were friends for 10 years.
Okay.
And we never lived in the same place, so we always talked on the phone. And I think one of the things that was really easy was just how much we had in common, even though we had very, very different experiences growing up culturally, and you know, just in regard to that topic. But of course, yes, it's an issue that's always yeah. present in our lives, and it's something I'm much more aware of.
Right. Okay. Let's move on a little bit. So a question we want to look at, there's a quote by John Powell, the legal scholar, that being white means you can reap the benefits of living in a racist society without being racist yourself, or at least perceiving to be racist yourself. What do you make of that? I mean, in terms of, I mean, is it what responsibility do white people have? And I'm going to ask this one to you, Sarah, first. What responsibility do white people have as non-racists to the challenges of racism in our culture?
Well, I'll start off with a little bit of like one way of telling my story, which is I'm a Midwestern girl. I was born to parents who were really hardworking. Only my father has a college degree, and he obtained that working nights and multiple jobs. And you know, they worked really hard and kind of made it. I was a smart kid. I did well in school. When we moved to South Carolina, I was in honors and AP classes in high school. South Carolina was awesome. You know, I moved there and I was like, I'm moving to this fun beach state. And it was. It was warm. I hung out at the pool. I had friends. I had a good time. I would say I drove around in cars. This was the 80s, listening to loud music like Madonna and Prince and Led Zeppelin. And I will say I'm sure we were in many a gas station where we were obnoxious and rude and loud and annoyed people, but I never feared for my life in any of the shenanigans I got up to in high school, I'll say that. I went to college, a great university, I had a good job, and I've always worked, and pretty much anything that has ever happened to any of those other people that I went to high school with, whether it's about their health, their education, their jobs, their economic situation, has absolutely nothing to do with me. Mm-hmm. I mean, that could be one story, right? There is a lot more to the story. When we moved to South Carolina, South Carolina was 48th in the nation in education. My parents easily moved into a neighborhood that put me in a nationally ranked public top high school. You know, so I got those honors and AP courses. Mm-hmm. I went to university. There was pretty significant busing into our school, so our school was integrated, though it was resegregated by class level. So despite there being a significant African-American population, I was only ever in an honors class with one or two people in my grade. You know, those people experienced a smile to the face and a whisper behind the back by some and kind of open hostility, that sort of thing. But you know, I could, you know, still kind of ignore some of that. Though I did find myself when I was 17 at a backyard party in our nice neighborhood, and I overheard two dads talking about how there were so many people moving into our neighborhood, and it was very transient. There were a lot of international folks, but they were sure that no black people would be moving in, and that was a good thing. And I remember thinking, you know, that's kind of shocking. But you know, all that to say, I personally benefited from institutional racism. You know, I was in the school, I was in the classes, I was in the neighborhood, I was in the place that allowed my success. And the things I had are things that we would want for everyone, but they weren't really available to everyone. And I'll add that, you know, what kind of changed some things for me was going to college, and just I got involved in community work and other things, and you know, I was moved out of my comfort zone. And I think that's one of the things going back to, you know, the series and Amos. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Amos really tried to make people uncomfortable. And one of the things that made me uncomfortable was a realization that I had that no one had ever said this to me directly, but I realized as I got involved in the community, I was working with people of color, people who hadn't been to school, I realized that I thought that because I was educated, because I went to this fabulous university that spent a lot of time telling us how special we were, because I had a certain economic background that I was sure everybody aspired to, that I looked and behaved a certain way, I realized that I thought I was better than other people. That was very uncomfortable. It was more comfortable to realize that it wasn't true. But I think that discomfort, at that time, there was a lot going on with me for my faith, too. And I think this whole idea that Jesus calls us to be healing and be in healing relationships As I started getting involved in issues of social justice, poverty, racism, et cetera, I realized that I was the one who needed some healing. And I found myself in situations where people were talking about issues and they were upset and they were angry. And it was like, you know, mm-hmm. it made my heart beat and I right. felt sick about talking about it. And I realized that I needed to not take it so personally, that it wasn't about like, you know I wasn't racist and I had good intentions, but I had to learn to be uncomfortable with that. Mm-hmm. And I had to learn to, you know, kind of get out of my comfort zone and examine, you know, some of those areas of benefits that I had,
right.
even though I didn't.
So you would not have called yourself a racist, obviously.
Oh, no. I mean,
you were aware of racism, mm-hmm. and you were aware of
bad.
You were aware of institutional racism, mm-hmm. and how society is unfair. But there was still this discomfort about connecting that to yourself.
Yeah, because I think if you know, what's the implication? Like, if I got something out of it, if I mm-hmm. benefited from
right.
it, like, should I have not gone to college?
Yeah,
should
right.
Should I have not it, had those things?
Yeah.
And did that mean I had to give up something?
Yeah. Know? So what did it make you think?
I think the other significant thing it did was it opened me up to the other discomfort was just opening me up to the pain that other people mm. experience, people of color experience, whether that was individually or families or community.
Yeah.
And I think that's the biggest thing about, you know, racism and the institutions that segregate us dehumanize people.
Yeah.
But when you can see, you know, XYZ happens to whatever person, and if you put yourself in those shoes and think about that could mm-hmm. happen to you. And really feel what that pain is like.
Yeah.
You know, how do you not act?
Right.
How
so,
do you not, how are you not responsible?
So, maybe we'll come back to this a little later, but you felt a sense of responsibility,
yeah,
right?
Absolutely.
So in other words, even though you're not, you wouldn't call yourself racist and you're sensitive to those issues, you felt a sense of responsibility for, okay.
Yeah.
Let's just go to Melinda. What about you for that question? Do you want me to restate the question or?
Well, I mean, I think that Sarah brings up a really excellent point. And I think the one of responsibility is a really cogent point, because when we talk about privilege, and I think your life story is really powerful, because often when we talk about privilege and when white people hear privilege, they think of economic privilege. And the fact is, in this country, we all have a racial identity. And for people of color, that identity is embedded, for the most part, with oppression. And for white people in this country, it's embedded with privilege. And I'm just gonna say up front, I'm gonna say some things that strike you as uncomfortable. I'd just like you to hear me and listen and just kind of let it soak in, because I think through the listening and the hearing, there's learning to be gained. When we look at what's happening in Baltimore, how many of you are familiar with what occurred in Baltimore last night? The backstory to what is taking place in Baltimore is pegged to a 23-year-old black man who was running from the police. He was caught, he was tackled, he was put in the back of a police van. When that ride ended, his spine was severed, his voice box was crushed, and he subsequently died. Last night, there were protests. The police, Baltimore Police Department, met those protests. There was a lot of talk about people being trapped in Orioles Park. There was conversation in the media about windows being broken. Before a window was broken last night, a man's spine was broken. A man whose spine was broken because he ran from the police. How many people in this audience right now, if you were walking down the street, would fear the police chasing you? The fact, how many people sitting in this audience right now, if you saw a policeman standing and you started running, would fear a policeman chasing you? That is a real issue, because for people of color, for black people, they have a reason to fear the police. They have a legitimate reason to fear the police. And the fact that you would not fear the police is privilege. That's what privilege looks like. Privilege looks like Oprah Winfrey, one of the richest women in this world, walking into a store in Switzerland, and they don't want to sell her an item because they think she can't afford it. That's what privilege looks like. Rory spoke, I think, last month about wearing a hoodie and jogging and being fearful. That's what privilege looks like, being able to jog and not having that fear. There's a gentleman who wrote a story, and he talked, it said something like, when I started bicycling, that's when I learned about white privilege. And he used the metaphor of bicyclists and drivers on cars. And he said, roads are made for drivers. As a bicyclist, you often feel fearful. You're riding your bike, roads aren't made for you. They're perfectly nice people behind the, you know, driving the cars, but they don't see you the same way if you're on a bike as they see another driver in a car. If a bicyclist said, you know what, car drivers, you need to make room for us. You need to realize that it's not a level playing field. Would you feel guilty? Would you say, wait a minute, that's not our, you know, these roads are ours, and no, we're not gonna do that. No, you would hear them and you would say, okay, yeah, maybe that we need to make some accommodations because this is not neutral. We need to level the playing field. That's what black people, that's what people of color are saying. It's not about shaming you, it's not about making you guilty, it's about opening your eyes and saying, you need to make room.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think one of the, first of all, Devin, have you anything, was there somebody, you wanted to respond, I think. Well, somebody was a minute ago. Devin, did you have anything to add or share about this?
No.
It's fine, that's totally okay. I don't blame you, buddy. I don't blame you. So I just wanted to jump in there to say that, because you made a request right at the beginning there that just, could you just listen? You know, and I think that's kind of at the heart of all of this. And throughout this series, not that we're going to listen in this series and then stop listening, but that, you know, I think these are really uncomfortable issues, aren't they? I mean, they're just so uncomfortable. And, you know, I think if white people don't feel defensive, then they're probably not really in touch with their feelings, right? So, but I think, you know, I guess I want to sort of appeal as well that we would just listen. And I think that there's this, part of addressing the privilege issue is to say, like, the onus is on, in this situation, the onus is on white people to listen, right? You know, it's, when we're talking about an oppressive situation, and I don't think that anybody would argue with the fact that African Americans in this country, you know, by definition in this country, have experienced incredible oppression, right, historically. No matter what you think about the situations currently, that it behoves us just to listen and empathize as the beginning to transformation, as the beginning to change. So I really appreciate you sharing that, Melinda, and that appeal. I'm gonna go on to ask a question, which is maybe jumping ahead a little bit, but what can we do? I mean, what qualities, what actions can white people adopt to be allies with African American people, or with people of color, like not, right. You're not even just applying it specifically to
the most important thing a white person can do is to be bold, to speak up, not to commiserate.
Mm-hmm.
I think back, I have a ton of white friends, and they're lovely people. And when Michael Brown and Eric Garner was going down, they would come to me like with zeal to tell me that they defriended all their racist friends on Facebook. And my response to them was, why? And it was like a badge of honor, you know what I mean? Mm. Like, if it was a family member, it was a little bit more complicated, but. You know, and my response, like legitimately to them, was, I want you to talk to those people. Because you can have a conversation with them that I can't. And I want them to say to someone who is on Facebook railing about how, you know, Michael Brown stole cigarillos, that it was that worth dying for? And in this country, isn't everyone innocent until proven guilty? Isn't that what we have courts for? Did this police officer not, you know, was he not judge and jury, like, in the street? And as a white person in your family, don't we have kids who've gotten in trouble? You know, don't they get in trouble? Have they ever feared for their life? Have they ever been shot down in the street? That's the conversation mm-hmm. that I want them to have with their family members mm-hmm. and friends. I don't want you to excise racists from your network and circle. I want you to engage them. I want you to have a courageous conversation with them.
Which comes back to this discomfort issue, right? We withdraw from that discomfort.
Let me tell you something. I'm tired. I mean, like, I'm gonna be honest with you. Like, as a person of color in this country, we have these conversations all the time. We need to share the joy. We need you to have these conversations too. And we need you to recognize that you can say things and your voice, because of the system that we live in, amplifies farther. And it can be heard differently. And that's an important attribute, that's an asset that you bring. Mm-hmm. I also need white allies not to be post-racial or colorblind, as Sarah said. Mm-hmm. That's not a compliment. I'm black.
Really?
I want you to see me. I know, it's shocking. I want you to see me as a black woman. Because when we're colorblind, when we're post-racial, we're masking having those kinds of courageous conversations because we're all good and it's kumbaya and, you know, it's rainbows. No, it's not. But you can't solve a problem unless you address a problem. Mm-hmm. And in order to address a problem, you have to see race. You have to be able to say racism. It's not a bad word, right? We can have these conversations, but you can't transcend race. In fact, that perpetuates racism because it makes it taboo.
Right, right. Let's come along the line here, Sarah, on this one. So we've touched, actually, we've touched on a couple of issues here. We've touched on, okay, what, this follows on, I think, from where you left off with your, what you were sharing last time about, okay, I have some responsibility in this.
Right.
So what can I do? And let's extend that out to what can we do? There's also that issue that Melinda's brought in there that of being colorblind. Like, it, you know, how do you have any comments on that and the problems that Melinda's raising there?
Well, again, I think on being a white ally, you know, it's pretty simple in some ways, which is, you know, Kamau Bell talks about, and Melinda talked about, at an early age, having to think about themselves the way other people think about them. And I think one of the things I didn't say earlier is that, you know, even though it's perfectly obvious to me that I'm white, I didn't really realize that I was white until I was in my 20s. I mean, that may sound ridiculous, but it's like, oh, they're a part of a group, but I'm not part of a group, right? So some of that is realizing I'm a part of a group. And so some of that work about awareness is stepping outside of yourself and looking at yourself and being curious, right? When you see the Kamau Bell video, and you know, there's a montage of pictures of African American boys and men. What's your gut reaction? What are the things that you think about them? You know, we have these gut reactions that we get, not just consciously always. So I think, you know, the first step is really stepping outside of yourself, being curious, being conscious, and learning and listening. And then the second part is doing your own work of that education. So, you know, I could talk to Melinda, and I actually have learned a lot from Melinda from being a part of this series, from reading her blog. But when it comes to me needing to learn, I need to do some of that myself. And, you know, I think about this again, you know, there have been times I do a lot of reading, I go to trainings, I, you know, do things. And there are some books I've read, things that, you know, I've talked to Hubert, I've talked to other coworkers, like, oh gosh, I read this great book. You know, there's a book called Uprooting Racism by Paul Kibble. And it just goes through and has you stand in the shoes of other people and learn some things. And I was like, this is a fantastic book, you know. And, you know, they were like, you needed a book to tell you that, right? You didn't know these things. And again, it was just the difference of people who've been living with things and seeing the institutional for a long time. And I think then it extends to action of being aware of where you are, of being aware, you know, when you're at work, who's at the table, who's not at the table, who talks, who decides. And then realizing that we all have a sphere of influence. You know, whether it's your family or friend, wherever, but, you know, start from where you're at and take some action.
Yeah, that's cool. What about you, Devin? How can people be, how can we be allies? And maybe even from a, you don't have to address it as a young person, but, you know, from even for, you know, other young people here, how, what can we do?
I feel like, in, like, I know in school there's lots of, like, yeah, like I said, jokes about it, but I feel like if people stop, like, noticing stereotypes are like, stereotypes are like a big thing, like maybe not like super important right now, but I know they're like really, really big in school.
Yeah.
If like stereotypes, I feel like are a big problem, because like people will think, oh, he does this and that, so if I don't do this and that, I'll stay away from him. And then you tell other people that and they'll think that, and then like it creates some problems sometimes. It can be nice sometimes, I guess. But That's just one of the things I feel is bad, and like I might have been a part of that, but I'm not like I don't try to do it as much.
Right.
Often. Like
if so, it's, breaking those stereotypes and speaking out against them, or breaking across those barriers. Yeah. Sorry, you were gonna. I think you were gonna say something. Okay. Something. So what? I'm gonna come back to you in a second. Right. I've got a special question for you. Just wait. So what I'm hearing here is that not noticing race is not going to make racism go away, right? But probably not noticing race is a privilege that really is in the domain of white people, right? I mean, we get to do that, so that's something we can do as a way of just pushing this away and pretending it's not there. The challenge is to notice and to speak out, to do something about it. And I think what you're both saying there in what, well, you too, Devin, in terms of the interactions at school, is that's a very personal thing. It starts off in a very personal way. And so that's something that we can all do, right?
Right.
I feel like the not noticing race thing, I feel like that's like, as you're saying, that's not like worth anything, because if somebody's black, then they're black. They can't change that. Like, you have to accept it. They can, I guess, act like a white person, but they're black. They're born that way. They can't change it. If they're white, they can't change that. So it's like there shouldn't be like white allies or white enemies. There should be like people, and they have a specific skin color. Like, and they have. It's the mindset that's that matters, not the actual skin tone.
That's cool. Thank you. Now, Devin. You're a multiracial young man. I don't know if you know this, you're part of the largest demographic, or the fastest growing demographic in the USA, right? So how has what's been going on in the culture recently, how has that impacted you specifically? Just share a little bit about that. Because obviously that video we saw is already sadly outdated in a way. I mean, there's been so much more that's happened since then, but you know, we were talking earlier about what's happening in Baltimore last night, but share a little bit about that.
I've experienced many things. One of the things being like, since I'm part black, people that know that, they think, oh, he's good at basketball. So like whenever I play basketball, I suck at basketball.
You suck at basketball. Darn it. Yeah. Well, I suck at basketball, but I'm white, so I get away with it. So.
Yeah, so. But there's also like, what is it?
Well, you were telling me a little bit earlier what people, they make assumptions about your race, right?
Yeah.
Okay, that leads them to ask you certain questions.
People used to think I was Mexican, or still do sometimes.
Yeah. But you're not Mexican,
I'm
right?
I'm not Mexican at all. So I remember having jokes made in like eighth grade about like people asking if I'd mow their lawns, stuff like that. Um, And people have thought,
well, that's not stereotypical, right? Man, yeah.
Yeah, there's people always think I know Spanish.
Like, yeah.
Whenever I'm walking, or like in Montgomery County, there's a lot of Hispanic people. I've been spoken to in Spanish many times, and I'm not that good at Spanish. Mm. There's also been like, at school, people will associate what clothes you're wearing with like a specific race. So if I'm wearing like, I don't know, khakis and a nice shirt, they'll think, oh, he's a white boy. Or like, mm-hmm. if I'm wearing joggers and a trench coat, they'll think, mm-hmm. oh, he's black, isn't he? Something like that.
Yeah.
Like, it all depends on like what you look like mm-hmm. in school, like your clothing. So there was pressure. Like, I remember mm-hmm. freshman year, I tried to fit like both, and that wasn't very easy because I'd have to wear like, because they're like, they're two separate,
yeah.
like styles, I guess.
Yeah.
In school, at least. And as of this year, I started like not caring. Like, I'd wear what I want to wear. And
you just gave up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's no point. And I feel like the whole race part is stupid. Like, it's kind of falling apart in school because there are people that are like, that are white, that are hanging out with black people. And mm-hmm. it's like, some people find that weird, which is mm-hmm. weird because it's not weird. and like, school is mixed.
Mm-hmm. So that's interesting. Do you see some hope then in your generation that there's that people are more able to cross those lines?
Yeah, I feel like noticing like in the school. Yeah. At least, I know I talk about school a lot.
Well, that's your life, right?
like it's very like everybody's like kind of sticking together. Like I don't hear a lot of talk. Like, there are some people that talk about the nowadays stuff. There's mm. not that many racist people in school though, because my school is one of the very mixed schools. I've got like mm-hmm. there's a good mix of everybody, like of all mm-hmm. the races.
Yeah.
In my school. But it's mostly like white and black, and nobody says anything like out like bad about what white people or bad about black people in my school.
Yeah.
They all just get together, and if you don't like a person or their style or something, you leave them alone.
Yeah.
And that's really like how it is.
Yeah. What about, let's come back to Melinda and Sarah. Do you see, is this something that's going to get better with time? I mean, what you know, something there that Devin's talked about in experience in his own school. What does that say? I mean, is that real, do you think? That's obviously, where do you go to school?
North County High School.
Okay. So that could be specific to that school, to this area, to, you know, what any comments on that?
No. Mm-hmm. I think that individual racism, yes. I think that individuals and how they grow in their mm. awareness of racism can certainly modify their behaviors. And I think that we often think that, you know, racists will die out, you know, mm-hmm. as people become more racially conscious, that racism will become less of an issue. And I think for individuals, that might happen.
Right.
I mean, it hasn't happened for I don't know how many generations, but, you know, mm. hope springs eternal. I think the challenge comes, though, in that racism isn't just individual acts. And mm. I think we tend to, when we think of racism, we think of, you know, the Klan and people using the N-word. That is individual racism. There is also institutional racism. There are systems that perpetuate racism that will not go mm. better at a time. They're not gonna sunset unless
right.
we make very intentional, purposeful actions to dismantle them.
Mm-hmm.
And when I say systems, when you look at incarceration rates in this country, when you look at the fact that incarceration in this country is on a downwards, they are incarcerating overall fewer people, but the numbers of black incarceration stays the same. When you look at education, like Sarah talked about education when she was in school and the number of, you know, black kids who are in AP courses, mm-hmm. the dropout rates, the percentage of black children in this country that have underqualified teachers, uncertified teachers, I mean, funding inequity, those are systemic issues. They're not based on any individual's actions, they're based on a system. And you can tick down, you know, that applies in others. I mean, look at health.
you know, in healthcare and access, all of in food justice, right? Mm-hmm. With our farm, and you look at mm-hmm. food deserts in urban communities where they can't get fresh food. You know, so there are many different systems. So the fact is, no, those will not grow out mm-hmm. or, you know, dissipate based simply on time.
Yeah.
It requires individuals like yeah. us taking purposeful actions to dismantle.
Yeah. Sarah, did you have anything to add there?
The AP question I had for my English exam was to write about the quote, the more things change, the more things stay the same. I did not get a 5 on my AP essay. But I think about that quote, and I appreciate being married to a historian, because I think that's a very cyclical answer. Mm. You know, there has been undeniable progress, undeniable change, undeniable good things. But then we also undeniably find ourselves, you know, I look at the book by Michelle Alexander, mm-hmm. Focusing on mass incarceration, and it's like, well, things may be so much better in so many ways, mm. but if you're one of the many African-American people or other person, people of color who are part of being mass incarceration and all, everything that goes with it, it's not any better.
And what's the title of that book?
That book
is The New Jim Crow.
The New Jim Crow, mm. yes.
Right? Because we thought Jim Crow was done.
Mm. Right.
With the civil rights movement, right? Mm. Chalk off hands.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. So, mm. So I find hope in that. You know, it's cyclical, and I feel like we're, you know, what are we going to do about it?
Right.
I live here and now, so what will I do to be a part of trying to change that?
Yeah. Maybe we can wrap up on this one, because time is pressing on. And we'll skip that video. We'll do this. But so we've been talking about a personal response, right? So what can we do? And yet there's got to be more than that, or change has got to be more than that. Like change has got to be more than everybody just being nice, right? Because it's institutional, it's systemic. There's structures in place that maintain the status quo. So at what point does engaging at a very personal level become institutional change? And I know that's a massive question, right? And we could be here all afternoon, but we're going to talk a little bit more about the issue raised next week as well. I mean, we have some more time then, not in this format. But anybody want to share a thought on that?
I guess I would say two things. There was a recent study by, I think it's the Public Religion Research Institute, that found that 75% of white people don't have any black friends. Mm-hmm. And I, you know, that's pretty typical of my parents' experience. That was my growing up experience. So, you know, one thing I think is you start where you're at, and Jesus calls us to be in relationship with people. So if you're one of those people who doesn't have friends that are not like you, and by friends I don't mean people that you work like. I mean, I would define it as like people you would have at your house for dinner, mm-hmm. right? Who will you have at your house for dinner? And if you have some work to do there, find a way to make new friends, you know, to branch out mm-hmm. a little bit. And then I also think we have to start where we're at, right, in our communities. I know in my community, I'm just really super involved in school. I live in Prince George's County, so I'm very involved in my daughter's school, and I'm very involved in advocacy issues of trying to improve schools systemically, mm. you know, for the people in our county. And I mean, there's so many things that you can do, but I think you got to start with yourself, start where you are, and you got to do something.
Mm. I mean, I would just echo what Sarah said. I think that it's not even just the friends and the lack of diversity in friendships. It's just our circles, right? There are studies that look at our online circles. You know, who do we communicate with? Who do we surround ourselves with? Relationships build empathy. I mean, I don't know any better way to say it. And so when you don't have any kind of relationships with individuals of a different race, and I know we're talking here specifically about black, white race, but I mean, pick a person of color in this country, and the story is the same. You know what I mean? You can take Native Americans, you can take Latinos, you can take, you know, Asian Americans. I mean, it's wide, but, you know, the point is it starts individual, and through individual awareness and actions, through that,
you become, we would hope, energized to say, this is unjust. Now, I see injustice, what can I do about it? Mm. Then there are many avenues for us to move in. And I know our, as a church community, we're going to be discussing that and looking at that. But you know, there are serious measures around police accountability and what that looks like so that we do not have things like Baltimore happening. But I don't know that you can get there if you don't see the injustice of the current situation as far as how the police in this country engage with Black and brown communities. If you don't see that, then you can't get to how do we deal with police accountability.
Right. Yeah. Okay. Anything you want to add at all, Devin? There. No, you get, they've said enough, right? any last comments at all about any of this that you guys want to share?
I'm a writer, so for those who don't know. So I actually did write out some comments.
Uh-oh.
No, it's really short, but I wanted to make sure that I said it precisely. So these are the last comments.
That's great.
Talking about race is challenging for most. There is a lot of fear and uncertainty about the topic. Race talk is hard in part because our racialized experiences are so different, and we come to these conversations with different stakes. Remaining silent on the topic of racial injustice isn't helping anyone, not your children, not your colleagues, not your family, no one. And it isn't moving the needle any closer to equality. In fact, data shows that it may be doing the exact opposite. There are clear and present racial inequities, and the only way to confront them is to admit that institutional bias exists. There is a clear disparity in this country in how Black people experience economics, health, education. Ignoring the reality of racism only makes us more racist. And I'm going to say that again. Ignoring the reality of racism only makes us more racist. And this is the part that touches me. Transformation is a part of our vision statement at Cedar Ridge. It's what we're called to as followers of Jesus, and to be transformed so that we can be a source of transformation for others. Church is the place for this conversation. If there's anyone here thinking, ooh, why did I come to Cedar Ridge this morning? No, this is the place for this conversation. I want to thank Matthew, I thank all of you for being here, for hearing us, for listening. This is where transformation can happen. This is fertile ground.
Mm. Thank you. Let's give these guys a round of applause. So I want to thank you. Oh, man, we're so way out of time. But I want to thank you guys for being so courageous.